Welcome back, everybody. I'd like to have you check us out at The Valley Outdoors. And where else, Donald?
On Facebook, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. Lots of cool stuff. And I mentioned last week, I talked to a customer. I said, hey, you should check out the Facebook page, or excuse me, our The Valley Outdoors page with the DNR connection. And sure enough, he did. And he actually planned a trip off of it, which is pretty cool. So it's kind of fun, but... yeah, check us out. Lots of cool stuff there. And maybe you already have a vacation planned. Why not figure out what else is going on in the area? Where are you going?
Where am I going?
Yeah.
Going to Canada.
Well, of course you are.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you not be?
Yeah, I got my standing reservation.
You got to love that. That's fun. That's fun. Well, Don, I've had this next story in the on-deck circle for a while. But you finally brought it up, then we have to talk about it. I think Ava's tired of printing it out for me. A Canadian man takes down an attacking moose with a .22 rifle. Yep, that's right.
Yeah.
Can you knock down a moose with a .22 rifle? The answer is yes, but it takes about 15 rounds. Just ask this gentleman from Stoughton, Saskatchewan. This last year, winter, he was going about his morning after having spent the night at his mom's house when he heard screams coming from outside. His mom had ventured out to warm up her vehicle and encountered a moose tucked against the house's dryer vent to reprieve from the numbing minus 40 wind chill.
Yikes.
This gentleman sprinted and found the moose standing over the top of his screaming mother. Appeared to be a medium-sized bull whose antlers had already been shed. He yelled at the moose. The animal turned and faced him, pinned its ears back, and we know what that means. That's a warning. Still, the moose didn't back down, so he opted to engage it in hand-to-hoof combat. He said his first instinct, he didn't think too well about it. I walked out and punched it in the face.
Oh, he didn't think at all about it.
The punch split the animal's lip, according to Sean, but then it turned and lunged at him. He grabbed a shovel and swung, landing three good blows. Then he retreated through the open door back into the house. The moose followed, shoving his way through the door frame.
Inside the house?
Inside the house.
He ticked him off.
The animal was stuck for a minute. Sean took advantage of it by putting it in a headlock. He ripped it out of my hands, turned, pinned its ears back, and he went to go back at his mom. So we had to run two or three steps outside and grab him by the face. I had him by the nostrils and the lips and pulled him back into the house. I'm like, oh, my goodness. So the mother of the boyfriend had been tracking down a .22 rifle in the house to try and bring it to help. He brought it to Sean in that exact moment. Sean recalls what happens next. The first shot was in the doorway. Got it and shot it in the head to go outside to get him another one. And then first clip, he couldn't see anything after the first three shots. He started to try and break the skull and get the point blank to shoot him in the head again. He reloaded another clip. And the next shot, 8 to 10 shots, were in the same position. And he said he reloaded about 8 bullets, clip of 22 bullets. And finally... he finally got him after the 15th round of bullets. How about that?
That was like a WWE smackdown.
That moose got a hard head.
So, a necropsy by the Canadian Wildlife Health Cooperative confirmed that at least one bullet had penetrated the animal's skull and went into the brain. He found the animal had already depleted the winter fat reserves and was basically freezing.
Yep.
Considering the facts, he doesn't think the moose attacked out of anger. Rather, he believes he was starving, weak, and acting in self-defense, was in survival mode. In terms of injuries, he walked away with a cracked rib, bruised lump on his head. Mother sustained a leg wound from being stepped on by a moose. Not a bad result, all said and done, going to fisticuffs with an 800-pound animal. With any luck, it's a one-and-done fight for this particular family.
He's very lucky.
I think the correct statement that he made was, he wasn't thinking too well.
Yeah. Obviously.
How do you go through that, Don?
Well, you don't.
Just say no? I agree.
Well, you go back in the house, get mom, bring her back in the house.
Well, I like the shovel
idea.
Shoot
him through the window.
The shovel idea was good. Punching it in the face was not good.
No. Grabbing his nostrils?
No. Not good.
No.
No. Headlock?
No.
That I do think the moose had to have been significantly weakened because a normal moose would have
pounded him.
It would have knocked him down and stomped on him, and yep. It would have been over in a heartbeat. So
that's
a good thing.
Yep.
That's a good thing. It ended it. All's well that ended sort of well.
Yeah.
As best could be. Set the table top of the show. We talked a little bit about what we're covering in top 10 conservation achievements of the 20th century. I thought that was kind of a cool little thing to talk about. Little interesting in my mind. When you look at it, they talk about the 20th century is probably the most transformative in the history of North American conservation. A lot of different things have come up in this era, and wildlife populations were collapsing, forests were disappearing, exploitation of natural resources, all those things were part of this, the 20th century, and the change that came about. And the key here was that there were all these changes that were driven by persistent influence of non-governmental organizations, which is the real takeaway here, which is kind of cool, mainly because state and federal agencies, they played minor roles with very few exceptions, and the rest of the reasons were citizen-led. We talk about MnFish. That's a prime example. In Minnesota, getting the funding to help the resource and manage the resource better and really increase the populations of fish and how they're regulated. So when we talk about those top 10 conservation achievements, that's kind of the thing to keep in mind and how it really has come about. So number one, the North American model of wildlife conservation, that was Boone and Crockett Club, foundation of the modern American wildlife management. The model established that wildlife is a public resource managed scientifically and allocated through law. It replaced market hunting with regulated harvest and remains a philosophical backbone of conservation in both the U.S. and Canada. That's Boone and Crockett. The Pittman-Robertson Act, that's hunting organizations, firearm companies, conservation-minded legislators. The law created an excise tax on firearms and ammunition, funneling billions into wildlife restoration. Advocacy from hunters and conservation NGOs was essential in both its passage and continued support. It was a big deal. That's all it continues to be. Recovery of the white-tailed deer. That's state-led conservation organizations like Michigan United Conservation Clubs, etc. And as you probably remember, back in the era when whitetail were overhunted and they were on the decline. Whitetail was in serious trouble. They were almost removed from the Midwest, and they have rebounded to historic highs due to regulated hunting, habitat management, and public support. The grassroots organizations help normalize regulated harvest and habitat stewardship, and really the monitoring of populations, whether we're talking CWD situations, where trying to regulate where and how those deer harvests are protected from being exposed to the rest of the population. Those are key pieces of what this really brings about. So that was a big thing. The Migratory Bird Treaty Act, that was 1918. Again, Boone and Crockett Club and the National Audubon Society. Landmark law ended commercial exploitation of migratory birds and established an international corporation for wildlife protection. An early example of large-scale conservation policy driven by public pressure. So again, the public organizations are the ones that have been driving this and making some big differences.
Grassroots.
Yep, absolutely. And another one, creation and expansion of the National Wildlife Refuge System. Again, Boone and Crockett Club, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service together. Beginning, there was a Pelican Island in 1903. The refuge system grew to a vast network of protecting critical habitats. It played a key role in advocating for land acquisition and defending refuges from political threats. That's another good one. The Wilderness Act was created by the National Wilderness Preservation System, protecting millions of acres from development. So there's lands and habitat being protected, obviously helping that, demonstrated the power of organized citizen advocacy and shaping federal land policy. And when you look at the land policies through the national park systems and all the other pieces and parts, it's pretty amazing what's come out about from those areas. And increasing access is one of the biggest challenges we've had as far as hunting and fishing, and expanding those is what is and has been going forward with that. So a big deal there. Endangered Species Act, 1973, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service. It's one of the strongest conservation laws in the world. Endangered Species Act prevented extinction of many iconic species. And, of course, this was a big one. I've experienced, and I think we all have, whether we knew it or not, the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, development of a lot of different buildings and parts across the Midwest, and really cool stuff because in this particular case, it was a government initiative and it reflected the public demand for conservation action, restored forests, built park infrastructure, and laid the groundwork for modern land management. If you look at a lot of the buildings in national parks, that's what it was built by.
Right.
And it was crucial because 33 to 42, then that era when it was developed, it was people coming back from World War One and coming in World War Two, they were hired to work in the CCC and to build these amazing buildings with talented workmanship. And it was just something that was so cool. Just amazing piece of this. And a couple more, wetlands conservation. Ducks Unlimited was in charge of that. 1937, Ducks Unlimited advocacy has led to protection of millions of acres of wetlands. And we all know Ducks Unlimited has been around forever, and they're amazing, absolutely amazing what they do. There's another one, state-level conservation advocacy network. That's out of Michigan and Wisconsin Conservation Congress, both, and it's the a big piece of it. The state-based non-governmental organizations, they're bringing hunters, anglers, and conservationists to influence policy. And the Michigan United Conservation Clubs, highlight to them and a shout out. They had they've been instrumental in securing funding, shaping regulations, and defending scientific wildlife management in Michigan. So big guys there. So lots of cool stuff that goes on, and that's really the top grouping and what they've been able to do in the area. So
and there's lots more. I mean, like the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation and Presence Forever.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of regional ones, state ones.
And really the bottom line, I think, Don, is that there's a unifying lesson. There's one thing that brings everything to a head. Conservation succeeds when people organize. And if people are together to make this happen, it makes a big difference. And especially, you know, hunting and fishing organizations. I bring up MinFish again. They've done a great job of this, and they've really made a difference. So, neat story, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's jump into,
tell me about the cormorants in Michigan.
You want to do cormorants in Michigan?
Yeah.
You had to do that, didn't you, Don?
Yeah.
He wasn't ready for that one.
It's right there, buddy.
Oh, there you go, Don. Thanks. I appreciate it. I got so many papers here. I have papers all over the place. A proposal from Michigan. They're going to protect the fisheries and cormorants. That's been a big deal in Minnesota. I know we talked a little bit about it before the break. They've actually had hunts up in North Dakota and Devil's Lake. They've done the same in Leech Lake, and it really has positively impacted the fishery because the amount of bait fish and smaller fish that they eat. So that's a big piece of it. So out of Lansing, Michigan, legislation is aiming to curb work by cormorants to damage fish populations in the Great Lakes. And that has been filed by Michigan Congressman Tim Walberg out of the 5th District, introduced the Responsible Cormorant Management and Control Act to ensure effective science-based management of the double-crested cormorant. The bill directs the Secretary of the Interior to develop a regional management framework and be responsible for the take of double-crested cormorants, working in coordination with the nation's 4 regional flyway councils. This particular bird long posed challenges for fisheries when the numbers become overabundant. In the Great Lakes, the populations have wreaked havoc on fish stocks, inflicting millions of dollars of damage to the Great Lake fishery. Great Lakes fisheries are essential to Michigan's economy, outdoor recreation, and the cultural heritage, Walberg said. Recreational fishing across Great Lakes generates $5.1 billion in economic benefit. and supporting local jobs and tourism throughout the state. When a double-crested cormorant populations grew beyond sustainable levels, they can significantly deplete fish stocks. Legislation ensures that we have responsible science-driven framework. And really, this particular act, the bottom line is, it's providing a science-based proven framework, and how do we address that particular part of that infringement of a animal in overabundance.
Have they determined how they were going to manage it?
I know in the Great Lakes on Green, like Green Bay, they'll go out onto, for example, Hat and Little Hat Island. Those are two islands in Green Bay that are absolutely devastated. There were trees on there many years ago when I first started fishing professionally. And over the years, cormorants move in. I mean, don't be downwind of that, those two islands, let's put it that way. It's horrible. And what they do is they'll go out there and they'll shoot the birds.
Well, I think that's what they did up on Leech Lake.
Same
thing.
There's
an island that they...
They put deer stands out, and they would shoot them out of the deer stands.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I'm talking this standalone deer
shot. Or
yeah. And it made a huge difference. I was amazed at what devastation. Same with Devil's Lake. Devil's Lake, it would literally, they killed off 500, at least 500 some odd trees throughout one just section of the lake. And of course, what did they do to the fishery? Who knows what that impact is, but significant to say the least. Speaking of significant, I'm hoping everybody has a significant fun time this weekend. It's going to be enjoyable in the outdoors. We're coming into an absolutely fantastic time of year. Hope you have fun in the water, fun in the woods, wherever that may be. Be safe. And, of course, thanks for listening to us. For Don, Abe, and myself, I'm Eric. We are the Valley Outdoors. Join us next week. It's going to be a great one. See ya.
Thanks for listening to the Valley Outdoors Radio. Catch us next week, same time, same place. Have a great day on the water or in the field.